Support for The Common comes from Davis Malm. Their tax attorneys take the time to understand your unique goals and find the most cost-effective ways to accomplish them, distilling complex tax laws down to clear choices so you can make the best decisions. DavisMalm.com. DavisMalm.com.
Hey, it's Daryl C. Murphy, and I just want to talk to you real quick. The Common is produced at WBUR in Boston. We're public media. We don't have paywalls, which means we don't ask you to pay to see our work. We say, here's some powerful stories for free. And then, if some of those stories you read or listen to are important to you and you talk about it with your friends and family, and you even see the world a little differently, then we ask you to support it. Because we want to continue making work that is meaningful to you. And right now, I want to let you know what's happening at WBUR. Our radio shows, our podcasts are getting some of the biggest audiences we've ever had. Our journalism is winning awards, reaching new and more diverse audiences. And you are a big part of that. Our journalism has never been stronger, but the business has never been harder. We've had a big loss of sponsorship dollars, like a lot of media companies have in recent years. But one thing we've always been pretty good at is getting support from our listeners to make the things they love. So we're asking right now, in a crucial moment for WBUR, can you help us get through this by joining other listeners in supporting WBUR? We need your help to keep making the podcast you're listening to right now, along with everything else that comes from WBUR. Your help would mean a lot to me and to all of my colleagues. So please, head to our website, WBUR.org. Thanks.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. WBUR reporter Ariel Gray. Hello, hello, hello.
Hey, Daryl, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Great, because I get to talk to you about a really fascinating story. I guess it started with a house in Boston, right, on Mass Ave, that not a lot of people know about. So I guess I want to start there. Tell me about this house.
So this is a house on Massachusetts Ave, right down the street from Boston Medical Center, that I personally, being from Boston, I've walked past it, I've driven past it, and I never knew that it had such a fascinating history and past, specifically when it comes to Black history in Boston. And when I was doing a little bit more research, I came across, you know, the history of the house and the fact that it's the headquarters for the League of Women for Community Service, which is Boston's oldest Black woman-led organization, which is just fascinating. It just blew my mind that there was so much history in this house, and I had walked past it so many times, and I'm from Boston and I went to school here, and I never knew about this organization and all of the amazing work that they've done throughout the years.
So that part of the South End, right near the Boston Medical Center, it's a pretty busy location. A lot of people have probably walked by this house and never thought about it.
Yeah. And you know, it's down the street from MEDA. A lot of people go to MEDA, and it's a little bit set back from the street. But currently, you know, the windows are boarded up, the door is kind of boarded up, there's scaffolding outside. It kind of just looks like a brownstone that's been under perpetual construction. And I think that may contribute to the reason why some people just kind of walk past it. But if you stop and look, you'll see there's a sign there that says, you know, what this building was, what the league is all about, and all that stuff out front.
Yeah, let's get into that. This house is the headquarters of the League of Women for Community Service. I say is because they're still currently operating, even though the building has fallen into disrepair. So what is the league all about?
A lot of their work centered around providing community services. And so they would also host things like plays and weddings and socials at the house, because at the time, Boston was still very segregated. And so, you know, Black folks couldn't stay at certain hotels. A lot of Black college students couldn't even stay on campus. And so that was another service that they provided at that house. They provided boarding in rooms to Black female college students who were going to school in the area who couldn't stay on campus, one of them being Coretta Scott King. So they did a lot. They had teachers on staff. They had social workers. They offered so many different types of services because they recognized that liberation exists in all of those different things. It exists in having fun. It exists in the culture. And it also exists in doing community work as well.
Tell me about the depths of their community work, because I would imagine back in the day living in a segregated Boston, this place sounds like an invaluable resource for the community, you know?
Yeah, and it was. And, you know, one of the things that I heard over and over again talking to Kalima Red Knight, who is the current president of the league, and to Dr. Johnny Hamilton Mason, who is a Simmons University professor and one of the researchers working with the league to catalog their history, is despite all of the odds that existed at that time, they still provided a safe space for Black Boston. And it really was an invaluable resource for the community. It gave people a place to go. It gave people a place to have a wedding, you know, if you couldn't book a hotel. It provided a safe space for female students. And beyond that, you know, they did a lot of activism, you know, pushing for better education in public schools. And a lot of it goes back to the founder of the league and the first president, Mariah Baldwin, who kind of made that her life's work, the uplift of the Black race through education and community work.
Did the league host any historic figures, or did they work with anybody? So I'm thinking of W.E.B. Du Bois, perhaps, you know, some folks like that.
I'm not quite sure if they were necessarily hosted at the league's house, though I'm sure there were a ton of prominent Black people who did visit the league, like in person. But, you know, where a lot of that comes in, I think, is looking at the connections that different league members and league presidents had. They really had a national network and they were speaking to other people. And so for, you know, folks like Ida B. Wells, Frederick Douglass, though they, you know, passed before the league was technically founded, they were still in communication with women who would then go on to lead the league. Mariah Baldwin in particular was an amazing person. And Kalima Red Knight, the president, talks about her so much because she's not as well known as some other folks. But, you know, she was the first Black headmaster of an integrated school in Massachusetts. And she hosted Harvard students, Black Harvard students at her Cambridge home. And one of those students was W.E.B. Du Bois. So it's not so much necessarily just the house, it's the people and the connections that they made with others that's also really important.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Ariel Gray.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell me about how the league changed as Boston desegregated.
Yeah, this was another thing that we spoke about at some length. And I think this is a question that a lot of Black folks in America ask themselves was, you know, was desegregation a good thing? It kind of inadvertently led to the decline of the league. And one thing that Kalima had pointed out was, you know, women's clubs were very popular at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. It was a way for Black women in particular to organize. But those kind of fell out of fashion as the decades went on, and people found other avenues to express their desire for civil rights. And just the idea of a women's club in general just wasn't, I guess, as appealing to folks. And then that, along with desegregation, hotels opening up, other venues in Boston opening up, campuses opening up, kind of decreased some of that pertinent need that the Black community here had for the league headquarters. And it all kind of coalesced and contributed to, you know, the eventual decline of the property itself.
You know, that's so hard to talk about. When we talk about desegregation, you know, we think critically about what that meant for our spaces. Now you hear people craving for those safe spaces, you know, where it's just them amongst their own, because there's some things that maybe not everybody will understand, you know.
Exactly. And I think, you know, these spaces were created because we had no other spaces to turn to. And then by virtue of desegregation, it made it really hard for places like the league to continue to operate. And then that, along with, like, these women were not capitalistic in mindset. You know, they could have really found ways to capitalize off of the fact that they had this space, but instead they really opened it up to the community. And I think that is also, you know, a contributing factor. They weren't necessarily trying to make a profit. They were pulling in funds, you know, from the borders and things like that, but that was just to kind of sustain. They weren't, you know, charging an arm and a leg to host a wedding or to host a play. It was really about providing a space for the culture. And yeah, unfortunately, the need for that space declined after a while.
With that said, tell me about what the league is doing now. What kind of impact are they looking to have in 2023?
I think that their priority right now is raising the millions of dollars that it's going to take to restore the property to its original condition. And because the property, it has such historic significance, they can't just go in there and replace, you know, replace the mahogany and rosewood finishes with oak, or, you know, just replace the stained glass windows. Everything has to be restored to its original condition, to the best of their ability. And that greatly increases the cost of restoration. And so right now they're running a capital campaign to raise the rest of the money that they need in order to get this done, because they do want to open back up the property and to have it operate in the ways that it did all of those years ago, and to provide that space again for Boston. You know, I think the other thing that was really interesting when I talked with Kalima Red Knight was letting people know that this space is here. And she talked about this a lot, actually, and about the fact that, you know, she's from Boston, she grew up here, and she didn't really know about the league and its history.
I had no idea that Black people were so prominent and did such amazing things in this city. And I sometimes imagine what my experience would have been like had I known this information and had I had a space to go to where I could see myself.
You grew up in Boston. You know what I'm saying? I see you as a true blue Bostonian through and through. How do you feel knowing that you've passed this building several times without knowing what it is, and that it has this deep, rich history?
I think it makes me feel, you know, that Boston does what it does. And I think that is, it hides a lot of this history here.
You mean Black history?
Yeah, Black history. Black history. History like the league. History like Mariah Baldwin. And so I think about that fact, and the fact that there are a lot of people like me who grew up here and don't know that there was a whole beautiful grand space geared towards not just Black women, but marginalized people in general.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it's just a testament to how hidden this stuff is in Boston. And Boston has this reputation of being, you know, progressive and the home of the abolition movement and all of this other stuff. But at the same time, a lot of the information that exists about these amazing people that made these things happen, it's not readily available. It's not talked about. It's not celebrated, and it's not highlighted.
Well, Ari, thank you so much for bringing us this story. It is simply fascinating, and I really appreciate you taking the time to share it with us.
Thanks for having me on once again, Daryl. I appreciate it.
That's WBUR reporter Ariel Gray. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Common. Make sure you hit us up on Instagram or Twitter at WBURTheCommon or thecommon@wbur.org. And now, it's that time for me to let you know that The Common is produced by Franny Monahan and Caitlin Harrop, with help this week from Nora Sachs. It's mixed by Emily Jankowski, Matt Reed, and Paul Vikas, and it's edited by Ben Brock Johnson. And from the newsroom of WBUR, I'm your host, Daryl C. Murphy, and I'll talk to you soon.